Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Fidel Castro and word from his brother and temporary successor Raul. But first, a newly released U.S. government report from the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction describes what it calls a second insurgency in Iraq, corruption, which has seriously bogged down the U.S.-led reconstruction effort. The reconstruction is slowly drawing to a close, but hundreds of jobs remain unfinished. For instance, Baghdad residents still have 8 hours of electricity per day, less than before the war. And we're learning today that one company hired by the contractor Halliburton paid $4 million to settle fraud allegations in Iraq. The reconstruction problems have gotten so bad that one senator who's taking testimony in a hearing on the issue today has quipped, "We paid for air conditioning and ended up with a ceiling fan." Well, joining us from Baghdad from a scratchy cell phone is New York Times correspondent James Glanz. James, hello.
Hello from Baghdad.
Well, this second insurgency of corruption, as it's being called, where is it coming from? Is it among Iraqi officials or from American contractors?
Well, I think it's, on both fronts. Early on, especially in the reconstruction effort, Americans stole money, and some of those Americans have admitted to doing that now and are in jail. There's money for reconstruction projects in Iraq. Those investigations continue. I think there are about 80 cases last I checked. Now, more recently, it's felt that corruption has really become widespread in the Iraqi government. And as many of those reconstruction projects are handed over, that becomes more and more of a problem as well.
We understand Iraq has opened up 1,400 criminal cases alleging perhaps upwards of $5 billion of theft by Iraqi officials, including theft of oil?
Most of the credible claims of smuggling involve petroleum products like gasoline. You could say billions of dollars of those products are smuggled each year in Iraq, and it's hard to quantify that completely, but it's a huge business here.
You've been writing in the past few days about the Children's Hospital in Basra. It was promoted by First Lady Laura Bush, wildly over budget, over time. Again, corruption, mismanagement?
Well, the allegations there are mainly mismanagement, and also it's a story of a project taken by surprise on the issue of security in Iraq. If you take the Inspector General's report seriously, it looks like they also just simply weren't very forthcoming about the escalation of costs, the extension of their time schedule, and they didn't report that accurately to Congress.
What does the Special Inspector General's report say about the U.S. coalition using American companies, including a division of Halliburton, formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, as opposed to Iraqi companies in Iraq reconstruction?
I think there's a general realization that the basic plan to bring in these huge contractors to run things from an American perspective was probably wrong. The Inspector General has quite a bit of information on that material in these reports. It has some recommendations that this shouldn't be done again. But the way they worked was they were called design-build contractors. So you would give them the money, and the idea was they would first design the project, then they would sort of subcontract out the construction to Iraqi firms. And it turned out to be an enormously cumbersome process. It was pinned down by American regulations that really don't work very well here. The idea now is, wouldn't it be more efficient just to give the contracts directly to Iraqi firms? There are a lot of good engineers here, and they're going to be doing the construction work anyway. Why not cut out the middleman?
Well, James Glanz of the New York Times, your colleagues at the Washington Post write today that hundreds of jobs aren't finished in the reconstruction in Iraq. Key projects in limbo, for instance, one to create 140 healthcare centers, created only 20. A crucial oil pipeline, 2 years behind schedule. You're there in Baghdad. As you look around, what do you see? Do you see things finished? Do you see things yet to be finished? I mean, how does it feel to you on the ground?
Well, you don't want to overstate. I mean, you do see projects that the Americans have planned and actually finished. I mean, I was the other day over at a power station called the Baghdad South Power Station. Two big turbines there are churning out electricity. It was an American project. Overall, though, Iraqis themselves pretty much dismiss the program as a huge failure, something that doesn't have much impact on their lives. And I think in the end, that's going to be the measure of success. If they can persuade the Iraqis that they've given them more electricity, better water, they can claim success. But right now, they haven't done that, and there's little prospect that they will.
New York Times correspondent James Glantz in Baghdad on a new government report released today calling corruption in Iraq reconstruction the second insurgency. That's the sound from Little Havana in Miami as Cubans there anticipate the demise of Fidel Castro's Cuba. But a statement purportedly written by Castro warns that rumors of his demise are premature. The Cuban government released the statement last night. In it, Castro acknowledges that his recent intestinal surgery was serious, saying, "I cannot make up positive news." He also can't, he writes, give details, saying that because of threats posed by the U.S., his health is a state secret. Well, we want to take a few minutes today to talk about Fidel Castro and what it would mean if his temporary replacement, Brother Raul, becomes permanent. But first, a check-in in Havana with Gary Marks of the Chicago Tribune. Gary, how are Cubans reacting to Fidel Castro's illness, and what are you seeing on the streets?
The operative word is normal. I mean, it's almost an eerie, a very eerie feeling here. You know, they essentially are going about their daily duties. People are going to work. People are, grabbing ice cream. They're playing in the parks. I mean, it's very eerie. It's almost as if nothing extraordinary has happened, even though we know that this actually is an extraordinary event. That at least is on the surface. Underneath, in private, people are obviously very concerned about the future, very worried about what may happen, et cetera, et cetera.
Could you try to flesh it out for us? We understand that there are Cubans who have only known Castro their entire lives, generations, and he's a grandfather figure, and others who hate him. But could you flesh that out more? I mean, how do they feel about him?
You know, it's very, very complex, to be honest with you. And every Cuban has a different opinion. I mean, most Cubans, even those who are opposed to this system, admire Fidel Castro in one way or another, either for his social commitment to social programs and education, or because, in fact, he's a world leader. He's put Cuba on the map. I mean, even after all these years, if Fidel goes overseas, you know, 10,000, 20,000 people will come to hear him speak. So even people who want political and economic change here have some respect for him. Yeah, obviously, diehard revolutionaries, don't want to see him go. Those who want change sort of told me, basically, they say, you know what, if change has to come and he dies, well, so be it. But nobody is really jumping for joy here in Cuba because he's facing possible death.
Well, it's interesting you say that because we are hearing analysts saying that the possibility is that in either the transition or a vacuum that opens up, they expect some civil unrest, people demanding some economic change. You're not feeling anything like that bubbling up?
Listen, you got to live on this island to really understand the place. You know what I'm saying? I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen. I can tell you right now it's very quiet, and it could change on a dime. But right now I don't see massive protests taking place. I mean, obviously the leadership knows there is pent-up demand, especially for economic reform. People in Cuba don't really, to be honest with you, they don't really understand, you know, multi-party democracy. It's been 47 years of one-party rule, and that's all they've heard is about how awful multi-party democracy is. So I don't think people are necessarily focused as much on that.
That's Gary Marks, Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Well, here's how one Cuban worker summarized Castro's health scare. It's like a small test of how things could be without Fidel. Fidel Castro, the world's longest-serving head of state, handed power temporarily, he says, to his younger brother Raul before his surgery to staunch what Cuban authorities described as sustained intestinal bleeding. So the world's focus is once again on this small Caribbean island. What does it say? Well, different things. Many countries, most notably Venezuela, embrace Cuba and its leader. But though many Americans travel there and dollars from Florida sent to relatives in Cuba are an important part of the Cuban economy, the U.S. government dismisses Cuba as a dictatorship and by law maintains no relationship. Well, we turn now to Julius Feig, the Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Inside the Cuban Revolution, published in 2002. Julia, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Glad to be here.
And can you paint a picture for us? Different people see Cuba in different ways. You know, some as a major tourist destination for people from all over the Western world, including the U.S. They travel, you know, Americans have to travel through other countries to get there. But there's jazz on the beach, a heady nightlife. But do Cubans that tourists don't get to see get enough to eat? You know, flesh out the picture for us.
Well, 15 years after the collapse of the socialist bloc, the truth is that the Cuban government has been able to maintain, sustain, and even build a pretty effective social welfare net, so that although people don't get a lot to eat, the state guarantees a basic subsidized lifestyle, subsidized food, subsidized health and education, subsidized rent, subsidized electricity. That is to say, the island exists in a world in which almost nobody else lives today on this planet. And so Cubans have, they now have a mixed economy. There's foreign investment there. As you say, there's some tourism. Cubans are highly educated. They are very, very successful in the sciences, the hard sciences, the soft sciences, the arts, the humanities. A lot of money goes into public health and into education. And because of that, and because they've been able to sustain those basic social indicators, which are competitive with those of developed countries, frankly, the government still has a great deal of legitimacy. But having said that, and as Gary says, the it's not a multi-party democracy. There's only one period in Cuban history when it could have qualified as a multi-party democracy, from the very late 30s until about the early 1950s, 1952, and it was a flawed experience at best. It's one that generated Fidel Castro. But in any case, so people, if anything, the pent-up demand is not only for economic demand that Gary mentioned, but it's also for jobs and opportunities to channel all of this education, all of this sophistication into productive jobs. There aren't enough of them.
And into all of this for everyone. Julia Schwag, we're coming up on our break, and we'll come back with Julia. But I just want to point out that, of course, critics say, yes, Cubans get monthly rations for rice and beans, coffee, maybe cigarettes or cigars. They get cakes, a free cake on their birthday and wedding.
Right.
But it's not enough for many people, and they
of
do have health care and education. But even though there's a high ratio of doctors to patients, there aren't very medical facilities.
No, all of that is true. And, you know, when you distribute a small pie to a lot of people, nobody really has quite enough. And there are income inequalities now. There are distinct social classes and groups because they've opened up in the last 15 years. And so those people who until recently had dollars and now have other convertible currency or are otherwise plugged into the global market or to doing business do a lot better. And that creates its own tensions. And there are many things that are illegal. You cannot run a small business. Self-employment is extremely limited. Market activity is extremely constrained because too much market activity creates political interests that are separate from the government, and the government doesn't want that.
We want to talk more about that, about Fidel's brother Raul, what it would mean if he were to lead the country, with Julia Schwag, author of Inside the Cuban Revolution and also the Council on Foreign Relations, much more. What really goes on that island we're now all focused on once again? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Cuban Revolution. And Julia, we've been talking, about the Cuba that Fidel Castro built. And we'll remind ourselves how he first came to build it. But I just, to be clear about what you're saying about Cuba, do you think, as Fidel Castro looks on this country, is it a successful country, or is it one that, you know, like much like the Soviet Union, is just waiting for his death to collapse?
No, I think if we expect there to be a Big Bang theory of change in Cuba once he departs, that's entirely wrong. The fact is that he has created institutions that are self-sustaining. Of course, his personal charisma, his leadership, his authority, his convening power, all of those things will be irreplaceable. That's why Raul Castro talks about collectively running the country, and that's why Fidel turned over temporary power, not only to Raul, but to about a half dozen other individuals who run four or five other strategic parts of the country, economy, finance, energy, public health, and education. The point is that the cast of characters that's been operationally running the country under Fidel's watch for decades, several decades or less than that, will now be, you know, stepping up to the plate and doing it with, you know, without him overseeing it. So institutionally, bureaucratically, the country functions, and when he goes, it won't collapse. But neither does it mean total continuity because of external factors that they are sensitive to. You see those in the statements, and that can cause the kind of normality Gary reported on maybe to be shaken. And by those external factors, I'm talking about the Cuban exile community, and I'm talking about the United States government.
Right. Well, and let's just remind ourselves, you speak of Raul, Fidel's brother, and we're reminded that he actually was the first Marxist communist in the family when they both were part of the revolution. And your research shows that the roots of what's called Fidelismo are deeper and broader than what people might think. It's not just, as you've said, a one-man band, and it isn't under Raul either. But when it came about, it wasn't just a one-man band.
No, it absolutely wasn't. I mean, the myth is that a handful of bearded rebels, Che, Raul, Fidel, and a few others in the mountains, single-handedly with some peasant support, took down the Batista military and the dictatorship. But in fact, there was a broad, nationwide, cross-class, cross-party coalition of anti-Batista activists who, over the course of almost 10 years, agitated in different ways to bring that regime down. Castro's leadership by the end of 1958 was preeminent, absolutely. But he did it with professionals under his watch. He did it with people in the urban underground, that is, in the cities, who were carrying out what we would call terrorist insurgency today, but who saw themselves as insurgents and who saw themselves as being politically and strategically equal with Fidel and Raul and Che up there in the mountains. Up until only the last few months of the insurgency before Batista collapsed. So it really was a broad, widespread movement, and Fidel took control of it by the end of 1958.
Right.
And then, of course, consolidated after that.
Right. And now, the Soviet Union propped up Cuba for many years. In fact, Raul, we understand, not a newcomer, no puppet. He was the one who made the missile deal with Khrushchev. But what about now? You mentioned the factors that might affect a future Cuba. You mentioned exiles, the U.S. government. What about Venezuela, thought widely to be the country propping up Cuba now?
Well, I think Venezuela is an important new factor in the equation, only in the most recent of two or three years. $70 a barrel of oil gives Hugo Chavez a great deal of revenue, and he is spreading the riches in his petro diplomacy, and it has given Cuba a new boost, not only directly through subsidized petroleum, but indirectly. You know, they've got together this eye operation program where their Cuban doctors, funded by Venezuelan money, are providing health care and eye cataract surgery to poor people from throughout the Caribbean and Latin America. That boosts Cuba's diplomatic standing. Cuba.
In fact, Julie, I just want to interrupt for a second. Don't many Americans make their way to Cuba for health care?
Some Americans do, and of course, American students go there for medical school, as do other Latin Americans. Now, propping up, I think, is maybe too strong of a language. Mm-hmm. This is not as deep of a relationship yet as Cuba came to have with the Soviet Union or the old socialist bloc. The size of the subsidy is not as large, and the depth of the institutional relationships between Cuba and Venezuela is not yet as intimate or sort of institutionalized as what Cuba had with the Soviet Union. But, of course, Hugo Chavez sees himself as carrying Castro's mantle. I think he's won't be up to the task. There are many Cubans in Venezuela, far fewer Venezuelans in Cuba, I should add. Cubans are pretty allergic to having outsiders run their country, or the perception that they depend on outsiders plays against the nationalism that has always been part of that nation. So I think that to say prop up is probably questionable, although the Cuban leadership will want to maintain the relationship that they do have without deepening it too much, because that's not popular either.
Julia Swag, just a couple minutes left. Back to the personality of Castro. We understand Cubans rarely call him by name. Many people, while speaking of him, stroke their chin as if to indicate a beard because they call him La Barba. They're afraid of being recorded or people spying on them. We've had Cuban exiles been coming forward in the last week reminding us of the loaded feelings about Castro. The Red Sox third baseman has been giving press conferences about how, you know, Castro killed his family. In the minute that we have, if in fact this is going to be the passing of Castro, what is his legacy going to be?
Well, I think it's a mixed legacy. He's been in power for almost 50 years, and that has hurt the body politic in Cuba, which hasn't been able to develop as fully as it would otherwise be capable of doing. But the legacy is also that Cuba as a country is on the map globally, and Fidel Castro did that, and Cubans are very proud of that. But for all of those families that have experienced division, that have experienced prison, that have experienced the kind of repression that has been part of this Cuban revolution, there's a lot of bitterness, and that's part of the legacy too. So I mean, I think it's very much a mixed legacy, but one that will go down as one of the 20th century's most important social experiments, and he is one of the most important leaders of the 20th century.
Oh, there are people who cringe when they hear the word important leader attached to Fidel Castro, but I understand. Julia Swag, Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Inside the Cuban Revolution. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is
on today as part of a new ground offensive. And in a dramatic airborne raid on a northeastern town, Israeli officials claim to have seized five Hezbollah militants. Hezbollah, meanwhile, fired a record number of 160 rockets into Israel. So far, at least 540 Lebanese and 55 Israelis have died in the fighting. And increasingly, the violence is being captured on video by civilians and posted on the internet, where anyone can watch the war unfold. Here, an air raid siren sounds in Haifa, Israel. And in southern Lebanon, speeding Israeli jets drop bombs. The video sharing website YouTube.com has become one of the most popular places to post these homemade war videos. The site launched in December as a place for young people to share often silly videos of each other, but now the lens is being turned on the Middle East fighting. Greg Sandoval of CNET News has been monitoring these videos on YouTube. Greg, what stands out for you?
Well, what's amazing to me is that many of the people are actually carrying the cameras and shooting as they dive into bomb shelters, or as rockets come slamming into buildings that are nearby.
Well, some of the scenes, as you said, were captured just by sticking a video camera outside the window. Let's listen to one that was posted by a 21-year-old man. He was on vacation in Lebanon on July 29th. It's taken from his balcony. Now, what you can see is some bright lights in the night sky, and you can hear artillery fire. Let's listen.
This is after... Whoa, there's an explosion. Look.
Oh, my God!
Greg, that was that young man's mom pulling him back in, and it seems maybe some citizens are feeling they're journalists and therefore protected by that camera.
Yes, but she's smart to be concerned because they are not, obviously, and it's war. I mean, they are definitely in a dangerous area.
Right. The way these videos come in, and I've got the site online right now, filmmakers have to register. They give their at least email names. They tell a little bit about themselves. But there's no way of knowing who they really are or whether or not their video is real.
There isn't. I mean, it takes 5 minutes to fill out any of the things that YouTube asks you to supply. And there's no verification. There's no pre-screening. It's not as if YouTube is going along and pulling out sham videos. Everything is up there. Fakes, phonies, legitimate video as well.
Although we understand that YouTube says that they do listen to concerns about videos and they will pull a video if there's something offensive. Is that right?
Well, that's right. But they have a criteria for what they consider offensive. And it has to be, you know, copyrighted material that belongs to somebody else. Pornographic or obscene or racist comments, but a sham video they wouldn't touch.
So it's viewer beware. And people are using YouTube to post personal opinions. It's almost competitive that way. YouTube says that they've never, you know, received this many, you know, serious videos.
That's the fascinating thing, I think, that I find the most fascinating is that now, unlike wars in the past, people from both sides can take their message, can take their side of the story, go to YouTube or Rever.com, other video sharing sites, and get their side. Disseminate, if you want to, their message, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, and get their message out there.
Here's William. Let's listen to him. He's about 10 or 11 years old. He recently fled Lebanon. Let's listen to a little of what he has to say.
Hi, my name is William, and I'm here to talk about peace for Lebanon. I'm Lebanese, so I'm supposed to know that Lebanon needs peace. And we had to leave from Lebanon. We had to go on an emergency trip to California right here. We just want peace. Peace, all we need. Peace, 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 peace.
And, of course, on YouTube, you hear many Israeli voices as well. Let's listen to an 18-year-old girl from Israel. This is her submission.
Hezbollah are bombing my city. Today they bombed, like, one of my friends' house is ruined. Everybody's telling me to leave, and I don't want to leave because my mom and dad don't want to leave. And I don't want to leave them here because that would be stupid. Because if something will happen to them, I will be far away and I couldn't save them.
Those last two young people, the young girl from Israel and the boy who says he's fled Lebanon, they could have been in a basement in New Jersey, for all we know, and had nothing to do with the conflict. But if you take it at face value, they can also be very powerful, these videos.
They are. I think that these kind of videos and these kinds of video sharing sites like YouTube are going to bring wars and huge news events into our homes if we want them to. YouTube is seeing probably now over 13 million unique visitors per month.
We understand that there are 100 million videos on the site.
Yes, and it's just growing exponentially.
And so people are now searching for Hezbollah and Israel to get these hundreds of videos regarding the conflict there. And they're often very graphic. I mean, I'm looking at pictures which were allegedly, you know, again, according to someone who posted it, taken by a BBC photographer of, you know, dead children. Incredibly, you know, horribly graphic pictures. Is that something else that YouTube is offering, or do they screen those?
No, they do not. If people complain about a video, they'll red flag it and YouTube will take a look. And if it's over the top, if YouTube finds it offensive and they think most people would find it offensive, they will remove it. But you will find many, many graphic images on all these video sharing sites. And I think that's a real big part of what YouTube and these other sites are offering. This is war, uncensored, uncleaned up. It is brought to you in all its bloody gore and fear and scariness and disturbing violence. Some of the images are beheadings. I've seen beheadings in Chechnya. You see actual men in combat being shot up close. They're killed, graphic wounds. If you watch this over time, it's one of the most depressing things. And I could see how young people might just think it's some kind of video game. It may not be as real to them.
I know you've also been following on YouTube the music videos that are being posted regarding Iraq.
Some Marines have put together some of the video and still photos that they took while they're in Iraq and accompanied that with rock music. They're issuing warnings to Al-Qaeda.
We're listening to videos that are posted on YouTube, the hugely popular website, with Greg Sandoval, CNET News, who's been monitoring these videos. And you know, we talked about the idea, Greg, that these are uncensored, unfiltered, and also anonymous. And there's, you know, sort of a credibility gap. Some people are saying that there may be a new generation coming up of YouTubers who will demand to have more, you know, credibility.
All it takes is for one video to dupe many people, for everybody to say, okay, we've got to have some way to verify these videos. But I think, though, that with so many people uploading video to these sites from the same event, you'll be able to tell which videos are real and which ones are illegitimate.
Greg Sandoval of CNET News. He's been monitoring videos on YouTube.com, the website. Greg, thanks for helping us take a look at them as well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, the mercury is nearing triple digits here in Boston and throughout much of the eastern part of the country, so we thought we'd just take a minute to go to the sizzling streets to ask, is there something you wear that's just a little different when it's so hot?
Today I chose to wear a light skirt and a sleeveless shirt that is really loose and flip-flops because I walk to work and it's so hot out.
This is probably the only tank top that I own, but it came in handy today.
I'm wearing a pair of light shorts and a tank top. I just left the gym and it's the most comfortable thing to wear.
So less is best, right? Well, maybe not. This morning, we at Here and Now were struck by the outfit worn by one of our producers. So Hitesh Hathi joins us in the studio to describe it, but you can also go to our website, here-now.org, to try to sneak a peek yourself. Hitesh, would you tell us, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing, Robin, what's called a churidar kurta. Ah. And a churidar is a bottom. It's, I think, sort of like a jodhpur. And in fact, it's the origin of the jodhpur. It's made of white cotton in this case, semi-transparent, but still decent.
Job for like someone would wear horseback riding.
Exactly. Mm. And in fact, it was an Indian prince on a visit to London who set off the craze for jodhpurs because that's what he wore when horseback riding.
So there, well, do you mind, you're also wearing on the top, that's the pant that you're wearing, the sort of the jodhpur, but on the top it's sort of a tunic?
It's a loose cotton tunic, again semi-transparent, but I want to say still decent because the less seen of me is better. And maybe that's the secret here. And it's got long sleeves and it comes down to just below my knee.
And the jodhpur part, which is your pant, is very sort of bagged and tight around your ankle.
That's right, but it's quite loose up top. And the tight, pleated look at the bottom is considered a fashion statement.
Ah, do you mind, Hitesh, just, I mean, I don't mean to be impolite, but would you mind standing up and, do you mind pulling up the top tunic so we could see the, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm sorry. Oh, see, very loose at the top. You're right.
And normally, only special women get to see that, which is to say my wife.
And my apologies. Well, we've seen, and most Americans have seen, people of Indian descent wearing these outfits. You are of Indian descent, but we should say born and raised in Uganda?
That's right, and actually with a many-year stint in Buffalo, so I know from cold weather. And this is a great warm weather outfit, but it doesn't work in Buffalo in the winter.
Well, why is it a great warm weather outfit? Because, well, we should say you had an interesting encounter with our colleague Tom Ashbrook, who is host of NPR's On Point, we should say this morning in the men's room. But it provoked a response from you, because what was he wearing and what did you think?
That's right. So I ran into Tom, who is our colleague, and it was where men meet in the men's room and don't usually talk. But he was wearing shorts and a short sleeve shirt, in fact, a T-shirt. And it occurred to me immediately that the experience of the physical is really metaphysical. We all think it's hot, but it's not the same thing for us. Just like one man's treat is merely a Twinkie to another man, you know. And Americans think that if it's hot, what you should have is short sleeves and short shorts. To someone like me who grew up in the culture I grew up in, that seems very hot. The sun beats down on you directly and then you get a little bit of sweat on you and then you get inside a building and the sweat feels very cold all of a sudden. Whereas if you're out in this loose cotton tunic, which is semi-transparent, the wind flows through it, you don't get particularly hot in the sun. It keeps the rays of the sun off. And when you're inside, you're protected, especially in modern air conditioning.
And we should say that there's a wonderful embellishment you have over your right shoulder, and I don't mean any offense, but it's sort of a long white sash with a blue trim. It looks something like a kitchen towel, very pretty kitchen towel.
And one of our colleagues said it reminded him of the diapers that his son has. They use cloth diapers. But this is part of the irrationality of any dressing tradition. If you grow up in a family like mine, you just have to wear this sash. It has no practical value. It's like a tie. It keeps blowing off, and it seems a little girly in America, frankly. You know, it's very interesting. All of my friends in America, the guys, the American guys, they also believe wearing clothes two sizes too big is comfortable. I come from a culture of tailored clothing. The idea that something is more comfortable when it doesn't fit your body seems very odd. Things tailored for you obviously feel more comfortable.
Here and Now producer Hitesh Hathi with his thoughts on warm weather clothing here in the U.S., shorts and such. I can't imagine, Hitesh, what you think of a halter top. Hitesh, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Oh.
of Ricky Bobby, actor Will Ferrell of Elf and Anchorman fame takes on NASCAR. Ferrell co-wrote and produced the film and stars as Ricky Bobby, the wildly successful driver who counts his corporately sponsored blessings every time he sits down to say grace.
Dear Lord, baby Jesus, we thank you so much for this bountiful harvest of Domino's, KFC, and the always delicious Taco Bell. I just want to take time to say thank you for my family, my two beautiful, beautiful, handsome, striking sons, Walker and Texas Ranger, or TR, as we call them. And, of course, my red-hot smoking wife, Carly, who's a stone-cold fox.
Mm. That grunt of agreement comes from Ricky's fellow racer and second banana, Cal, played by John C. Reilly. Cal takes up with Ricky's wife after Ricky's fortunes change. He has a disastrous accident, a crisis of confidence, and a new competitor, a gay, French Formula One driver played by British comic Sacha Baron Cohen, creator of the fictional talk show host Ali G. Well, we recently sat down with Will Ferrell to talk about the world of Ricky Bobby.
Ricky Bobby is... He's kind of, you know, brash and cocky and southern, and he wants to either finish first or wreck trying, and that's how he kind of lives his whole life.
But he also seems to be the kind of guy that your characters seem to be, which is the kind of guy who wears his inner child on his outer sleeve.
Yeah, he's definitely, that's something I definitely like to do. Yeah, he's kind of a little boy. I mean, I like characters, too, who are really cocky, but at the same time have a little glimmer of self-doubt.
And need. I mean, I thought occasionally of Elf.
Yeah, he needs to be liked and wanted, and he kind of shows a lot of vulnerability, which is kind of funny in the context of a big, broad comedy. But, yeah, he goes through the full circle in this movie.
Dear Tiny Infant Jesus.
Hey, you know, sweetie, Jesus did grow up. You don't always have to call him baby. It's a bit odd and off-putting to pray to a baby.
Well, look, I like the Christmas Jesus best, and I'm saying grace. When you say grace, you can say it to grown-up Jesus or teenage Jesus or bearded Jesus or whoever you want.
My friend and writing partner, Adam McKay, who's also the director of the movie, our previous film, Anchorman, we had to clear so many hurdles in getting it made because this subject matter of anchor people, news people, as a comedy, it was hard to convince studios that that was a funny thing to talk about.
Really? That strikes me as odd.
Yeah, and we kept kind of saying, well, we're not really doing it about the news. These are just silly characters. And
I should say I was one, so at
yeah,
once.
Right. So
makes perfect sense to me.
Exactly. Right. And so as we analyzed that, we were thinking, for our next thing, we should just pick something that everyone knows something about, and something like NASCAR. And it was kind of a joke at first because we knew nothing about NASCAR, but then as we started talking about it, we thought this is a great, no one's taking advantage of writing a comedy about the sport or in this world, and that's how it started.
Really? You knew nothing about it, which would make you one of a handful of people?
Right. One of 10 people in the country. Yeah, we knew very little other than, you know, the top drivers and Daytona and some of the bigger races, but we just pitched it as simply as, you know, I would play a race car driver. Every studio wanted to be involved.
Is that because you didn't tell them that it would also feature as your foil a French gay man who tongue kisses his husband on the track?
We left that part out, yeah. We did tell them there'd be kind of a villain, so that was our villain.
We were wondering, watching the movie, what kind of a wrench that threw in the whole thing and who the audience for the movie is going to be given who this character is.
Luckily for us, NASCAR was game for all of this. They read our script and they said, okay, and just be kind of true to the racing, which is one of our goals. We wanted whatever we showed in terms of the sport to look real and intense, which is what you feel when you go to these races. You know, it kind of reflects their confidence in their sport, in their audience, you know.
That's stunning because when we were watching it, and it was a preview audience, but it was full. Everybody's just laughing and, you know, really getting into it. And then there's a moment where this, you know, French gay race car driver is revealed and absolute silence.
Yeah, depending on where you're watching the movie, it's either really shocking or a big laugh or both. But we kind of wanted that. You know, we felt like what would be the one guy who could step into Ricky Bobby's world and really shake it, and that would be a Formula One driver from France who happened to be gay.
Listen, you better be careful because tomorrow you're going to get beaten. beaten real bad, cowboy.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I want to know.
That's news. That's news to me.
Tomorrow you're going to be a cowboy. I'm going to rip you in the face. This is going to be a crap zone. I'm going to take
away. I play for keeps.
Tell us a little bit about this foil, this race car driver, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, who plays Ali G on this sort of faux cable interview show where he's lured some of the world's great leaders to come on the show and answer really ridiculous questions. What was happening in some of those moments where it was obvious you were improvising scenes together? Because there's a little bit of sort of unsettledness on the screen. You're nodding yes and laughing.
Yeah, that's why I love working with Adam McKay, is he will do the scene as written, which is, you know, usually the case in a comedy, and then you start to improvise and play around a little bit. But Adam will really let us just even go even further than a lot of other directors will. And there were moments where Sasha and I really didn't know what was going to happen, but he's so willing to take chances, and so am I, so it kind of shows up on the screen.
And then you throw the actor John C. Reilly in the mix, and all bets are off.
Yeah.
So
I got a new
it's
nickname,
so
the Magic Man. Now you see me?
Now
you don't.
That is the stupidest nickname I've ever heard.
Is it, Ricky? Because I think you wish you thought of it.
All right, you got me. That's an awesome nickname.
Watch the mail for that invitation to the wedding, because I want you there.
What?
Baby, he's not going to come to the wedding.
Cal, do you realize the implications of your actions right now?
What's the implication mean?
I don't know if this is happening, but I'm assuming people are looking for all sorts of deep meaning and metaphor in NASCAR, which is used as a political metaphor. And you say no, you just sort of picked it because it seemed like a good thing.
Well, some things we have a little edge behind it and a little special intent here and there. But a lot of times, too, we're just really trying to make ourselves laugh, kind of selfishly. We don't really even think about the audience, what they might think is funny. We just trust that hopefully they think the same thing is funny.
Will Ferrell, I just want to ask you, a big fan of Elf and a lot of your other roles, the cheerleader on Saturday Night Live, but the characters always do strike me as someone just determinedly hoping to find the best in people, you know, a guy who maybe breathes through his mouth, you know. Is there a time, is there something down the road that you might want to do differently, or is this, hey, look at me, I'm in this wonderful place, and why mess with it?
I think, comedy will always be a place I always live. That having been said, there are some other movies, Stranger Than Fiction, which is a film that comes out in November. That's a different movie for me. It's something played very close to the vest, even though there's a lot of comedy in the movie. It's probably the most kind of real performance I think I've given. So that'll be exciting to see what the reaction to that is.
You liked it.
I loved it.
Actor, writer, and producer Will Ferrell's film Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, opens in theaters this Friday.
Highway run into the midnight sun. Wheels go round and round on my mind.
I don't know about you, but I am welling up. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Sleep alone tonight. Sending all my love along the wire. They say that the road ain't no place to start a family.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.